Iris listeners, I'm your reader Dale Finnegan, and it's time to turn to today's obituaries from the Des Moines Register. From Perry, Shirley J. Larkins, age 67, passed away on July 20th after a year-long battle with cancer. She was born in Des Moines on April 13, 1953, to James and Virginia Stoker. Shirley retired from mainstream living after more than 25 years of service. Shirley is survived by her siblings, Linda Johnson, Deborah Kane, spouse Dave, Kathy Zimmerly, spouse Dale, and George Stoker, spouse Brenda Lundgren. Caregiver and special niece, Rhonda Stoker, as well as many nieces, nephews, relatives, and friends. She was preceded in death by her parents, James and Virginia, her brother, David Stoker, and her beloved cat and best friend, Spooky. Funeral services were held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, July 28th at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens, 121 Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines, with burial following at Highland Memory Gardens Cemetery. A visitation was held at the funeral home Monday evening from 5 to 7 p.m. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family in loving memory of Shirley. Online condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Joyce Ann Brown, age 79, of Colfax, passed away on Monday, July 27th at Park Center in Newton. Funeral Mass will be held on Friday, July 31st at 10 a.m. at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Colfax. Masks are required for the Mass. Burial will take place at the Colfax Cemetery. Visitation for Joyce will be held on Thursday, July 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Coburn Funeral Home in Colfax. Memorials may be directed to the Quarry Springs Park, and condolences may be left for the family at www.coburnfuneralhomes.com. The daughter of John and Vivian Evans, maiden name Jones, Joyce was born on September 19, 1940, in Colfax. She graduated from Colfax High School in 1958. On January 28, 1961, she was united in marriage to Bob Brown. This January would have been their 60th anniversary. Joyce worked as a secretary at the Colfax Tribune, Altoona Herald, and Colfax Dental, retiring 2014. She was a member of Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Altar and Rosary Society, and La Femme Club. Joyce was very active in her church and her community. She loved tailgating for her Hawkeyes, shopping with her grandkids, and always had to stop at Bath & Body. A trip to Grandma's always meant beef burgers, fruit salad, potato chips with dip, and if we were lucky, some of her cookies. She loved her coffee with friends and often could be found with a book or watching the Hallmark Channel. The family would like to extend a heartfelt thank you to the entire staff at Park Center and Wesley Life Hospice for all of the care and compassion for Joyce during this time. Those left to honor her memory include her husband Bob, her two sons, Jeff Brown, spouse Darcy, and Todd Brown, spouse Marianne. Three grandchildren, Annie Brown, Rachel Brown, and Grant Brown. Three great-grandchildren, Keaton, Paisley, Harper, and a sister, Marcia Jordan, spouse Dawn. Preceding Joyce in death were her parents and a granddaughter, Samantha Brown. From Ankeny, Colleen Music is selling Avon to the Angels. She passed away July 25th at Park Ridge Specialty Care in Pleasant Hill. A funeral for Colleen will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Ankeny Memorial Funeral Home, 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard. A visitation will start at 10:30 a.m. Colleen was born August 4, 1932 to George and Blanche Holland. She married Bill Music November 5, 1955. To that marriage, she had three children. She was a homemaker and a school lunch lady. Her hobbies were knitting, reading, and crosswords. She spent many winters in Texas with Bill, as well as camping in their travel trailer. She was a member of faith at Ankeny Presbyterian Church. She sang in the choir, and she taught Sunday school. She is survived by her sister, Lila Mills, her children, Richard Music, Rita Korn, spouse Randy, and Lee Music, grandchildren, Melissa, Richard Jr., Christine, Jill Hockmuth, spouse Corey, and Miranda Korn, spouse Mike, great-grandchildren, Brian, Nick, William, Chloe, Alana, Brooklyn, Blaine, Brody, Warren, and Waylon. Colleen was preceded in death by her husband, parents, and her grandson, Adam. Online condolences at www.memorialservicesofiowa.com. Bruce Donald Buchanan of Des Moines passed away unexpectedly on Sunday, July 26th at the age of 66. A public visitation will be held from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, July 30th at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale. A private funeral service will be held at 9 a.m. on Friday, July 31st. A live streaming of the funeral service will be available on Bruce's tribute wall at www.caldwellparish.com. A burial will follow at Forest Lawn Cemetery in Omaha, Nebraska. Bruce was born in Omaha on March 19, 1954, to John and Catherine Buchanan, maiden name Peterson. He graduated from Drake University and the University of Iowa with a master's in social work. He married his high school sweetheart, Linda Elsasser, on December 21, 1974, and together they raised two children, Andrew and Matthew. Bruce was the president and CEO at Compass Clinical Associates, one of the largest and most comprehensive full-service mental health agencies in the state of Iowa. Additionally, Bruce was a nationally sought-after trainer and lecturer in the areas of child and adolescent therapies, reactive attachment disorder, social work ethics, and residential treatment programming. Bruce devoted time to the Boy Scouts of America. He was an Eagle Scout, as are his sons, and a Vigil member, Order of the Arrow. But without a doubt, spending time with his grandchildren was his greatest joy. Bruce is survived by his wife, Linda, his children, Andrew, spouse Christy, and Matthew, spouse Sarah, his father, John T. Buchanan, his brother, Doug Buchanan, spouse Dawn, his sister, Mary Mock, spouse Keith, his grandchildren, Katie, Molly, Abby, Liam, and Maggie, along with several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his mother, Catherine. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to Mid-Iowa Council Boy Scouts of America, National Alliance of Mental Illness of Central Iowa, NAMI, Orchard Place, or Young Women's Resource Center. Online condolences can be expressed at www.caldwellparish.com. Beverly Joan Donnells, age 83, died Sunday, July 26th at Parkridge Specialty Care in Pleasant Hill. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st at the Wallace Family Funeral Home and Crematory in Newton. Memorials to the Central Christian Church in Waterloo may be left at the funeral home. Beverly, the daughter of Alfred and Jenny Trotter Wilson, was born on December 20, 1936 in Newton. She grew up in Newton and graduated from Newton High School in 1955. She was united in marriage with Robert Donnells on October 1, 1960 in Newton. They lived in many places during their married life, including Kansas City, Clinton, Macon, Missouri, Atlantic, and Waterloo. Beverly was a homemaker and was very active in her church. She enjoyed painting, crafting, drawing, and reading. Her all-time favorite movie was Some Like It Hot. Beverly is survived by her sons, Brad Donnells of St. Paul, Texas, spouse Leslie, and Brent Donnells, spouse Krista of Waukee. Grandchildren, Jackson and Olivia Donnells, Eric Donnells, spouse Lacey, Adam Donnells, spouse Mackenzie, Jane Donnells, Eric Walker, and Kelly Walker. Her great-grandchildren, Merrill, Thomas, and Philip, sister, Sherry Swanson of Wilmington, North Carolina, and her nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Robert Donnells, a sister Bonnie Calkins, and a brother. Screena Weaver of Perry, formerly of Marion, went to her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on July 24th. She was born to Peter and Juanita Reginald Bercier in Trail City, South Dakota on October 7, 1937. Screena grew up in a single-parent family, and her mother decided to move them to Waterloo for a fresh start at a new life. This is where Screena and her older sister Patricia Bolson attended Waterloo East High School, where she graduated in 1956. Screena went on to have two sons, Kirk, who is married to Brenda Rowe Weaver. They also have two sons, Jonathan and Luke, and her youngest son is Roger. Both are currently residing in West Des Moines. Screena decided to become a cosmetologist in the mid-70s to embark on a new career, which she made many close friendships over the years. Later, she worked at Aegon Insurance Company in Cedar Rapids. She retired in 2004. Besides work, she attended Gospel Light Baptist Church in Marion, where she also had made some close, dear friends. This is where she loved to spend most of her free time and showing her devotion to God. Screena worked hard her whole life until she was diagnosed with dementia in 2006. Her long, hard struggles with this unforgiving disease finally ended this past Friday morning due to complications of pneumonia and the dementia. She will be sadly missed by her two sons, daughter-in-law, and grandsons. Her sister Patricia and brother-in-law Albert and their two daughters, Gay, Anne, and Alice, will sadly miss her also. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, August 3rd at Isles Westover Chapel in Des Moines. Private interment will be at Cedar Memorial Garden Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Memorial contributions may be directed to Gospel Light Baptist Church in Marion. For those unable to attend the memorial service, there will be a live stream link available just prior to the service on Screena's obituary page at www.islescares.com, where you may also leave online condolences. Ida Jeanette Chess of Mission, Texas, age 89, passed away July 12th at home of cancer. She was born March 29, 1931, to Lloyd Gibbs and Cleo Oxier in Humiston, Iowa. She married Wayne Baird and had four children. Kristen Baird, Steve Baird, Corliss, deceased, and Brenda Baird McGee. Wayne died after 25 years of marriage. Then she met and married Richard Chess. After retirement, they moved from Des Moines to the Lake of the Ozarks, where they lived for 10 years to later move to Texas, where they lived for 31 years. Ida will be laid to rest at Merle Hay Mausoleum at a later date. Becky Shoemaker Geist of West Des Moines passed away unexpectedly on July 4th. She was born on April 2nd, 1950, to Ken and Clara Shoemaker. After graduating from Lincoln High School, she went on to study at Iowa State University, getting a master's degree in art. During her time there, she was a cheerleader and a member of Chi Omega sorority. Becky enjoyed teaching art and made beautiful pieces for everyone to enjoy. She took great pride in being able to do the flowers for her nephew's weddings. Recently, she used her creativity while working at Bozen's The Florist. Becky also was a receptionist at KCCI, where everyone enjoyed her bubbly, outgoing personality. She treasured her friendships with everyone, especially her Yaya group. Becky met the love of her life, Cullen Geist, and the two were married on June 19, 2004. They enjoyed a marriage filled with joy, laughter, sports, singing, and dancing. Cullen preceded Becky in death in 2010. Left to cherish her memory is her brother Kirk Shoemaker, nephews Keeve and Alex Shoemaker, and great-nephew Jake Shoemaker. She was looking forward to seeing her great-niece Kennedy, the first girl in the family since Becky was born. Her beloved dog Dallas will be going home with family to California. Per her wishes, Becky was cremated. There will be a graveside service for family and close friends in Mount Ayr, Iowa, on Thursday, July 30th. Memorials for Becky can be made to the ALS Association Iowa chapter at 3636 Westtown Parkway, Suite 204 in West Des Moines, Iowa 50266. Condolences can be made online through www.caldwellparish.com. Dorothy Lee Dakin, known as Dee, of Altoona, age 79, died at home on July 3rd. Visitation is from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, July 29th at Isles Grandview Park Funeral Home. Funeral services are 11 a.m. Thursday, July 30th at the funeral home. Cremation burial is 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st at Laurel Hill Cemetery. Dorothy was born at home in Altoona on March 19, 1941, to John and Norma Stormer Portinga, and graduated from East High School in 1959. She married Donald Dakin in 1960. They were married for over 25 years. Dorothy worked at James W. Bell Company in Des Moines until 1972, when she and Don were blessed with a daughter, Darla Leanne. In 1980, after her daughter was in school full-time, Dorothy began a 35-year career at Moss Distributing. She started working in the accounting department and was promoted to the parts manager. Dorothy met Robert Lentz through work. Their first date was in 1998, and they were engaged that Christmas. Those left to cherish Dorothy's memory include her daughter, Leanne Oldenburg, spouse Gary, grandchildren Dorothy Faith Contreras, spouse Juan, Adrian, Miranda, Dylan, Alessandra, Mirabella, Noel, and Owen Oldenburger, great-granddaughter Zena Contreras, siblings Daryl, spouse Sheila, Dale, spouse Judy, David Portinga, spouse Carol, Darlene Smith, spouse Tom, Dolores Weisner, spouse Tom, Dwayne, spouse Letty, Donald and Dean Portinga, spouse of Dean named Tammy, many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her former husband Don Dakin, her fiancé Bob Lentz, her parents, her brother Dennis Portinga, her baby sister Betty Jean, and her nephew Michael Portinga. Additional information is at www.islescares.com. Melvin A. O'Neill, age 92, of West Des Moines, passed away peacefully of natural causes at Regency Care Center, Sunday, July 26th. Graveside services with military honors will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Rest Haven Cemetery in West Des Moines. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, there will be no other services planned, and the family respectfully requests that masks be worn. Melvin was born June 24, 1928, in Des Moines, to Henry Anton O'Neill, known as Tony, and Mabel Alice O'Neill, maiden name Cucker. He grew up in Valley Junction and was a proud graduate of Valley High School in 1948. Mel enlisted in the U.S. Army during the Korean War and received an honorable discharge on October 18, 1951. He married the love of his life, Wilma Jean Sheets, on January 8, 1950, and lived in West Des Moines all their lives. Melvin started working for Northwestern Bell in 1951 and retired in 1990. He was one of the founding members of the West Des Moines Police Auxiliary in 1961. It was Melvin's way of giving back to the community he and Wilma loved being part of. He retired as a captain from the auxiliary after 21 years. Melvin had many, many lifelong friends. He was selfless, loved fishing, hunting, building remote control boats, flying gas engine airplanes, and anything that involved spending time with his family. Melvin was a longtime member of the Isaac Walton League and enjoyed the time he spent there with family and friends. The neighborhood children loved him, and to them he was always, and still is, Marvin. Melvin is survived by his daughter, Valerie Jean O'Neill, spouse Bill Kautsky, son Douglas Melvin O'Neill, spouse Kathleen, grandchildren Kent Young, spouse Shelby, Casey Young, Kelsey Gonzalez, spouse Dan, Justin O'Neill, spouse Catherine, and Julie Peterson, spouse Jacob. Great-grandchildren Cameron, Zoe, Tiara, Taryn, Savannah Jean, Ronnie, and Chase. great-great-grandchildren, Emmett and Neva. One brother, Robert O'Neill, or Bob, many very special nieces and nephews, and his friend and favorite traveling companion, Bev Howe. Melvin was preceded in death by his beloved wife of 45 years, Wilma, his parents, two brothers, Donald and Guy, and three sisters, Virgil, Elsie, and Barbara, and many dear family members and friends. In lieu of flowers, please consider a memorial donation in Melvin's name to the West Des Moines Police Reserve Association, 250 Mill Civic Parkway, West Des Moines, Iowa, 50265. Gail Hence Stein, age 77, of West Des Moines, died Monday morning, July 27th, at Edgewater. Gail joined the love of her life, Vic, on his birthday. Private family services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, August 3rd, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Waukee. The service will be live-streamed on the IELTS website. Go to IELTSCares.com at 9:45 a.m. Monday and scroll to the bottom of Gail's obituary to join in the service. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery in West Des Moines. Gail Marie Hentz was born on February 21, 1943, in Cincinnati, Ohio, to Vernon and Edith Hentz, maiden name Lucan. She graduated from Ursuline Academy in 1961. On May 9, 1958, Gail went on a blind date and met her future husband, Vic Stein. They married 4 years later on June 30, 1962. They celebrated 56 years of marriage before Vic passed in 2018. Yet, even in death, their bond remained unbreakable. They modeled every day what commitment and true love was, and together they raised three daughters in faith and love. Gail followed Vic wherever his career took him. The entire time, she worked tirelessly to ensure that when Vic came home from work, everything was perfect for him. She was a meticulous housekeeper and prepared a three-course meal each night for dinner. Gail was devoted to her family and building a foundation rooted in love, faith, and joy in her home. Gail guided her family by her faith and trust in the Lord. Gail is survived by her three daughters, Elizabeth Lefkow, spouse Bruce of Polk City, Donna Huseman, and spouse Terry of Clive, and Julia Rogiers, spouse Jim of Urbandale. Nine grandchildren, Katie Lefkow, Laura Esslinger, spouse Adrian, Lindsay Lefkow, Alex Lefkow, Allison Huseman, Jacob Huseman, Sam Rogiers, Emily Rogiers, Anna Rogiers, two great-grandchildren, Evelyn and Ella Esslinger, her siblings, V.J. Hentz, spouse Diane, of The Villages, Florida, and Susan Shentz, spouse Paul, of Loveland, Ohio, and sister-in-law, Anita McLaughlin, of Aurora, Colorado. She was preceded in death by her loving husband, Vic, and her parents. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to the Alzheimer's Association. Online condolences will be welcomed at IELTSCares.com. The Stein girls would like to express their sincere thanks to the staff in the memory care unit at Edgewater for the love, care, and respect that they bestowed on Mom daily. That concludes the obituaries for today. I'll turn now to the sports section of the Des Moines Register. The top story here is written by Chad Leistikow, and the title is Former Iowa DB Lomax Details Doyle's, quote, untouchable influence. With results of an outside investigation into racial bias within the Iowa football program expected to be revealed soon, perhaps this week, one of the most respected Hawkeyes of the past decade is confident that the biggest step toward lasting change has already occurred. The removal of longtime strength and conditioning coach Chris Doyle in a $1.1 million separation agreement. Former defensive back Jordan Lomax also explains that the early June airing of grievances was a final straw effort by black former players to draw attention to disparaging treatment from Doyle, something he tried to help solve behind the scenes 3 years earlier. The risk that you take when you go public is they can clean house, And we didn't want to see that, Lomax says. There's a lot of great men on that staff that have helped us out, that have families that have to put food on the table. Lomax is among the fraction of black players from his era who made it at Iowa. A native of Prince George's County in Maryland, a predominantly black area just outside of Washington, D.C., Lomax was among 14 black signees in Iowa's 25-player recruiting class of 2011. During his 5 years as a player, he saw the arrival of 58 black recruits, of which only 22 would finish their careers at Iowa. That beats 37.9%. Lomax became an academic All-American and captain of the 2015 team that completed a 12-0 regular season and reached the Rose Bowl. Lomax later worked for the university as a fundraiser, gaining new perspective on the business side of Hawkeye football. In short, there is perhaps no more impactful voice in moving this Iowa football slash race conversation forward, and Lomax agreed to share his experiences and thoughts recently in a joint interview with the Des Moines Register and The Athletic. During the conversation that stretched about 75 minutes, these were some of the most revealing points as ways to improve the Hawkeye program continue to be explored. And a list of 5 points follows. Number one, head coach Kirk Ferentz's biggest mistake was delegating Doyle too much power. Lomax describes Ferentz as being a Fortune 500 type CEO who is the face of the organization but has limited player interaction versus a COO strength coach in Doyle with year-round access to players, including via body monitors that tracked sleeping patterns and activity away from the football building. Everything pretty much that went into Iowa football, Doyle had some type of input into it. And I think that's where, when you give somebody that amount of power and that amount of autonomy, it's tough, Lomax says. Especially after the program starts to have success, as Iowa did in 2009 and with the 2015 resurgence. Because now it's like, okay, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So we're having success doing it this way. Let's keep doing it this way. And then, as time keeps going on, Doyle, it's almost, you feel like you're untouchable. Lomax credits assistant coaches Phil Parker, Seth Wallace, Kelvin Bell, and LeVar Woods for helping reassure him that he was valued at Iowa. A message he says Doyle didn't deliver. Lomax says it was common for older black players to warn new prospects about what they perceived as Doyle's belittling approach and racially insensitive jokes. And so, now, day one, you're attacking me. Now I'm thinking it is racially charged. His actions that he's bringing towards me, Lomax says. And so it's just a snowball effect. I think Doyle was entrusted with a lot of power, and I feel like he abused that power. And it should have been more about establishing relationships with the players first before you attack them with demeaning behavior or demeaning insults. Doyle, on June 7th, denied having racial bias and said in a June 15th statement that announced his separation from Iowa that he would refrain from comment until after the outside investigation was complete. I am confident that my record and character will be confirmed in the investigation, he said then. Lomax urges heightened accountability with Iowa's next strength coach. Raymond Braithwaite, who is black, currently holds that role on an interim basis. Number two, the Hawkeyes' on-field success can improve if personalities are allowed to flourish. For the most part, Division I football recruits were stars of their high school teams. That often can be accompanied by a brash confidence to compete at a high level. Lomax echoes a common theme among former players that such attributes were diminished at Iowa, regardless of skin color. Tight end George Kittle's big personality, for example, was diffused at Iowa, and he has since become an NFL superstar. Lomax saw playing time as an area that was overly influenced by information provided to Ferentz by Doyle, in which white players were given the benefit of the doubt over black players of similar ability. Lomax thinks if Iowa fosters an environment in which different personalities are embraced, we'll see overall player confidence and thus team performance improve. They wanted somebody that was just quiet. Don't speak a lot, Lomax says. Just go out there and just handle your business. But everybody's not like that, and you can't hold everybody to that same standard, because that's not how guys can reach their full potential. Number 3. Lomax believes genuine Ference is capable of leading change. Lomax has a unique position in the last decade of Iowa football in that he was able to spend time with Ference off the field during leadership retreats at Big Ten Conference Media Days in 2015 and a few years later when he worked for the UI Foundation at golf outings and other fundraising events. He thinks those who have attacked Ference's character are off base. He's a great guy. I've seen him just outside of football. He can lead the change. I'm confident that he can, Lomax says. And that's my personal opinion. I know others may disagree with it, but he can lead the change for sure. And I think he's demonstrated that with having to separate from his best friend, Doyle. Every program is going to have its issues, but at the end of the day, Iowa football is a good program, and we just wanted to see it better. Number 4. Lomax realized in 2017 that racial disparities had worsened and more pointed conversations were needed. 2 years gone from the program, Lomax watched from afar as he saw 16 white players and 2 blacks selected to the 2017 team's leadership group. That alarming ratio led Lomax to confide his concerns to former Hawkeye Lon Olenichak, who helped coordinate leadership retreats. Olenichak relayed the message to Ference, who then called Lomax, and opened the door for him to speak to black players on the team. Lomax jumped at the chance. And although he recalls outlining strategies for players to, quote, make it through the program, be punctual, toe the company line, don't go downtown, he wishes now he had talked directly to Ference about drawing attention to Doyle's role in driving away black players. From 2013 through 2015 recruiting classes, only 8 of 31 black scholarship signees, that's 25.8%, finished at Iowa. I was like, I get it. I know it's tough downstairs in the weight room, but unfortunately, that's just how it is. And that's probably not what I should have said, Lomax says. I probably should have fought more for them. And finally, number 5. One of the players who heard Lomax's 2017 message, James Daniels, became the driving force for change. That should serve as reassurance that Lomax planted an important seed. The 2017 conversation escalated awareness to racial bias concerns. A diversity task force was created in 2018 to study abysmal black student-athlete graduation rates. But the changes initiated in response to the results, such as allowing earrings, hats, and rap music in the facility, did not get to the root of the problem, and Ference admitted he failed to follow up with black players as promised after the 2019 season. That, Lomax says, is why former players, led by Daniels, an offensive lineman for the Chicago Bears, felt their message had to become public, particularly as George Floyd's death, while in police custody, stoked the national conversation about racism in America. And while former players await results of the Hush Blackwell investigation and subsequent next steps, Lomax is encouraged by what he's hearing from current players. That a dark cloud has been lifted. Long, quiet voices are now being heard. The biggest piece that needed to be changed got changed, Lomax says, with Coach Doyle leaving the program. The story at the bottom of the page is about state baseball tournament, and there is a photograph in the middle, a large photograph of Norwalk's baseball player Cale Eck, as he celebrates after tripling in a 3A baseball quarterfinal on Tuesday. You can see Cale as he's got 1 foot on third base and he is about to raise his fist in triumph. He's got a very expressive face and dirt all over his chest and leg as he apparently slid into third base to make that triple. The third baseman from CCA is standing behind him holding the ball after having apparently caught it too late. And here is the piece written by Tommy Birch. Norwalk baseball coach Chad Weidman didn't have much to say when he handed the ball off to closer Drew Leek in Tuesday's seventh inning. All Weidman did was ask what Leek had for pitches that day and if everything was working. Then Weidman issued an order, get it done. Neither one of us are big talkers, that's for sure, Weidman said. Everybody knew what needed to happen, and so we kind of had that understanding. Leek got the final two outs of the game, stranding the tying and go-ahead runs in scoring position as number four Norwalk held off number five Clear Creek Amana 4-3 in a Class 3A state baseball quarterfinal at Principal Park. That was crazy, said Norwalk outfielder Cale Eck of the ending. I had butterflies. It was nuts. The tense finish saw Clear Creek Amana stranding runners on second and third when Leek logged his third save of the season by getting Tyler Strepfner to fly out to end the game. Clear Creek Amana, with a 16-6 record, scored one run in the seventh and pulled within striking distance by putting runners on the corners with one out. Leek entered and retired one batter before the Clippers moved another runner into scoring position with a two-out steal of second. No matter for Leek, who kept his composure in crunch time. That's been his role all year long, is to get the last 3 to 6 outs. He knew the ball was going to be in his hand at some point in time, and he knows that that's what he does, Weidman said. He's ready for it. Norwalk had taken a 4-2 lead in the fourth inning, thanks to a pair of Clippers errors and a wild pitch. But Clear Creek Amana couldn't take advantage of the final scoring opportunity. The Clippers stranded 10 runners on base during the game and missed out on valuable scoring opportunities in the first, second, fourth, and seventh innings. Everybody looks at the seventh inning, said Clear Creek Amana coach Nick Zumsand. We had chances to get hits, get bit hits, and take a lead, or at least get the game even. We didn't take advantage of what we could. It ended a memorable run for the Clippers, who were making their first state tournament trip. Clear Creek Amana pitcher Brock Reed took the loss, despite striking out 5 in 6 innings of work. It's a scary season to be the top-seeded team at the state baseball tournament. Marion became the second number 8 seed this tournament to take down a top seed, knocking off number 1 Sergeant Bluff Lutton with a 3-1 victory in the Class 3A quarterfinals Tuesday at Principal Park. Marion joined Kingsley Pearson, which took down number 1 Martinsdale St. Mary's in the Class 1A bracket. It's just the second occasion since the tournament moved to Principal Park in 2005 that two number 1 seeds have fallen in the quarterfinal round in the same year. In 2006, Lamar's Gellin defeated Mason City Newman and Cedar Rapids Kennedy knocked off Des Moines Lincoln. The Indians were already one of the big surprise stories of the tournament, entering with a 10-10 record. They held off a late rally by Sergeant Bluff Lutton, which it now is 20-4. The Warriors used a 2-out rally in the bottom of the 7th inning to load the bases, but Marion pitcher Owen Puck got a strikeout to get his team out of the jam and end the game. Puck, who got the save, also went 2-4-4 at the plate with a run scored. Derek Fitzgerald went 2-for-3 for Sergeant Bluff Lutton. Along the side of this page is this article from Mark Emmert, COVID-19 cases shut down Iowa basketball. Two Iowa men's basketball players tested positive for COVID-19 on Monday, and the team will cease workouts for 2 weeks, the university announced Tuesday. It became the first Hawkeye sport to have to shut down since football players reported to campus for voluntary workouts that began June 8th. Iowa had announced Monday that only one of 20 tests for the coronavirus administered in its athletics department from July 20th through 26th had come back positive. All the men's basketball players were tested for COVID-19 upon their arrival to campus last month. Subsequently, they are only being tested if they're showing symptoms or it is recommended by medical staff. The two players were tested on Monday after the daily check of their temperature and symptoms indicated they might be positive, a university spokesman clarified. Iowa men's basketball coach Fran McCaffrey and his staff were allowed to be on the court with players for the first time July 20th. Coaches were wearing masks and were distancing themselves from the athletes, Iowa point guard Joe Toussaint told the Register last week. The Iowa Athletic Department had reported 27 positive tests as of July 26th, but those include athletes, coaches, and staff members. At that point, 533 total tests had been administered. Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz said at a July 16th news conference that some of his players had been among the positive tests, but none severe enough to require hospitalization. The football team has transitioned from voluntary to mandatory workouts without any large-scale disruptions. But 15 FBS programs have announced this summer that there were COVID-19 outbreaks on a large enough scale to cause workouts to be halted. Currently, Michigan State and Rutgers are among schools whose football programs are on a forced hiatus. At Iowa, the protocol is for medical staff to begin contact tracing for anyone who tests positive, to isolate those who do, and to quarantine anyone who might have been exposed to them. Moving on from sports, I'll turn to the Iowa Life section of the Register. There is an article here titled, "The Horse Rescuer." Runnels Woman Rescues Horses After House Fire. The article is written by Robin Opsel of the Register, and there is a nice color photo at the top of the page. It shows Deb Hoyt in jeans and a red t-shirt and a tan-colored baseball-type cap standing with one hand holding the reins of a horse and the other hand patting the side of the face of a very large dark brown horse. And she's standing in a grassy field with a green tree behind her. There's another smaller photo accompanying the article as well. And it shows Deb, the same woman in the same outfit, standing outside of a metal fence inside of which are two horses that are eating feed from grain buckets. And in this picture, the horses are wearing fabric, masks or faces, covers over their faces. I'm not sure if that's to keep the flies off or keep their eyes closed or what, but maybe we'll find out when we read the article. And here is the piece, again, written by Robin Opsel. Deb Hoyt is trying to get out of the horse rescue business. It's an expensive trade, and at 62, she's starting to consider retirement. But sometimes the call to help is too strong to ignore. One of those calls came in May. Seven horses in Washington, Iowa were left without caretakers after their owners, Cheryl Lynn Birch and Michael Lee Shannon, died in a house fire. "I knew right away this is something I need to do," Hoyt said. "I needed to be there for these animals." Hoyt runs Horse Heaven Rescue on her property in Runnels, where she and her family members care for and train horses. After beating cancer in 2003, she created the Rescue and Healing Hearts with Horses, a nonprofit that offered equine assistance, psychotherapy for foster, adopted, and at-risk children. The family has been trying to ease out of those efforts in recent years, but Hoyt still helps when she can. "When people ask me for help when they're doing the right thing in such a difficult situation, I step up," she said. Birch, 58, owned Country Charm Flowers and Gifts in Mount Pleasant, according to her obituary. Shannon, 66, was a veteran of the United States Navy who served two tours in Vietnam before joining the family business, Shannon Horse and Hound in Fairfield, according to his obituary. He was deeply involved in the horse industry and trained horses that raced at Prairie Meadows Racetrack in Altoona. After the fire, as Birch and Shannon's family members were sorting through the couple's estate, they realized there were 7 horses still on the property. The horses went days after the fire without water, which is what prompted the call to Hoyt. She immediately arranged to take time away from her job at a Runnels convenience store to go assess the horses. She and her adopted daughter, Ruth Gorman, 17, took the 3-hour drive to Washington on May 9th, along with others who agreed to help with the rescue. All of the horses were healthy and of good breeding, the kind not often taken in by rescues, Hoyt said. But the animals did not know basic commands, would not pick up their feet for people to inspect their hooves, and did not know how to load into a trailer. What should have been a 20-minute job ended up taking 5 hours, Gorman said. One of the horses was taken in by a neighbor in Washington. The other 6 were eventually taken to Horse Heaven Rescue. The rescue could not determine the names of any of the horses except for Annie, an older mare that may have raced at Prairie Meadows. Hoyt plans to keep her. The Horse Heaven Rescue team, including Hoyt, Gorman, and intern Crystal Orr, 33, is getting the rest of the horses ready for adoption. On one mid-July day, they concentrated on trust-building exercises with the horses, which had picked up names, nicknames like Sneaky Pie, Wonky Knee, and Big Red. The crew took turns separating each horse from the others and leading them one by one around a circular pen. Orr said the training was to teach the horses not just to follow orders, but to get used to trusting that the others would be safe without them. It's about teaching them that you are dependable, she said. No one's going to get hurt here. Nothing's going to happen, so they can relax. That's when work can actually start. Hoyt thinks it may be 2 or 3 months before the horses will be ready for adoption. People interested in helping or learning more about the horses can email Hoyt at healinghearts.com. Stay updated on the horses' progress by following the Healing Hearts with Horses Facebook page. There's still a ways to yet to go, she said, but we're making progress and we're making sure these horses get to live a good, long, happy life when they leave here. That's the least we can do. The other article at the bottom of this page is written by Robbie Sakira. The title is Ames Council Member Makes Glamard's College Women of the Year List. Rachel Junk made history at age 20 as one of the youngest women to hold a political office in Iowa after she was elected in December to the Ames City Council. Months into her term, she's still making headlines. Glamour magazine, now an online publication, recognized Junk as one of its College Women of the Year this month. The piece says that the 10 young women featured are, quote, coming of age in a world bubbling over with sickness, racism, inequity, and environmental devastation. And yet each one has made extraordinary efforts to clean up their share and then some. I'm particularly inspired by people my own age getting involved in their communities and running for office, Junk, now a senior at Iowa State University, told the Ames Tribune. My close friend and campaign manager, Taylor Blair, told me early on that the right kind of candidate isn't running for office for any political gain, but instead to meet the needs of their community and because they are passionate about making change. Between juggling a marathon campaign to unseat 2-term council member Chris Nelson for the Ward 4 seat in the runoff election and earning high marks as a chemical engineering major, Junk has seemingly handled all obstacles in her way. It means so much to be named one of Glamour magazine's College Women of the Year, she said. Reading through the article and seeing what the other 9 women were able to accomplish amazed me. And I was very grateful to be able to share my story and be included on the list. When Junk began her campaign last summer, she set out to find local solutions to address climate change and pushed for housing diversity and affordable housing. In the profile on the council member, Glamour credited Junk for providing a valuable voice for young people in local government, especially during a pandemic. I love that Glamour is able to highlight all of the different ways that college women in my generation are making a difference in their communities and impacting the world. And hopefully inspiring the next generation of women to do the same, she said. Junk, along with fellow council members, has had to adjust to virtual meetings and take a week-to-week approach in handling the pandemic. In her time on the council, Junk has had to weigh in on whether the municipal pools should open for the summer, how Ames should address face masks, and on the reopening of establishments amid a countywide surge last month. Junk said she's learned how to adjust to the decision-making process as a council member. Instead of just going off of my own background and opinions on an issue, she said, it is crucial to weigh community input, the material presented in the staff reports, additional data, and the opinions of other council members to come to a conclusion. As the Ames City Council continues to adjust to governing during a pandemic, Junk has also used her platform to pay it forward by inspiring and mentoring other college students to have a voice in local politics. I have had several individuals reach out to me for advice on running for office as a young person, and it is always wonderful to be able to share my experiences and help push for more representative government, she said. I've gotten to mentor several college students running for office in other states through the organization Run for Something. That's all we can fit from the Iowa Life section. It's now time for Dear Abby, where the title of the column today is Man Smitten by Second Cousin Hides Relationship. And the letter says, Dear Abby, 3 months ago, my husband ran into a second cousin he hadn't seen in 40 years. They were close for a short time during high school and saw each other a couple times after that. I was not aware until recently that he had looked her up on social media and has been communicating with her every day since then. I didn't think much of it until one night when he stayed on the computer with her until 3 a.m. He has lied to me about the number of times he has been online with her, and if she calls or texts, he tells me it is someone else. She sent him pictures, which I saw, yet he denied receiving them. One time he forgot to sign off on a message he sent, and of course I read it. To my shock, he was confiding a lot of things he has done while married to me that I was unaware of. It hurt me deeply, and I told him so. I have asked him more than once why this relationship is so private, and he says they are just friends. But when I asked to see some of the things he has written to her, he refused to show me. I said, fine, then I will ask her. He blew up. Am I overreacting? If so, can you please tell me how to settle down and deal with what is happening? Signed, Cousin Trouble in the Midwest. And Abby says, Dear Cousin Trouble, you are not overreacting. Call the woman and ask her what has been going on. If you feel there is any hope of saving your marriage, offer your husband the option of seeing a marriage and family therapist together. However, knowing he has no compunction about lying to you, you might prefer to simply consult a lawyer about your next steps. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And finally, the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m., so listen for that tonight. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It has been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned now for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.